From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Donald Trump is Time Magazine's Person of the Year. And in the interview he did with Time for the issue out today, he said he'll bring down drug prices that caused biotech stocks to fall. Meanwhile, we're learning more about the potential effects of Trump's plans regarding Obamacare. A new study from the Urban Institute finds that repealing the Affordable Care Act would leave an additional 30 million Americans without insurance. Republicans say that dire prediction won't come true because they're working on a replacement for the health law. CNBC's Bertha Coombs joins us to look at that. She's in New York at the NASDAQ Stock Exchange. Hi, Bertha.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, tell us more about this study's findings. And I guess we should say that the Urban Institute is seen as a liberal think tank.
Exactly. And one of the things they look at is if you repeal Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act through reconciliation. Reconciliation is what you would do in order to just repeal it through a simple majority, because then it's just an up-down vote. So the Urban Institute says the people who have gained coverage through the ACA with pretty substantial subsidies would automatically lose their coverage. But on top of that, the market for individual plans would become so destabilized that people who are buying without subsidies, individuals who before were buying on the market, would lose coverage. So that would actually mean the whole market would collapse, and even more people than before Obamacare would be out of coverage. A lot of people say that's not necessarily what's going to happen the way that it's going to be done. Paul Ryan's plan looks to replace some of this. And a lot of Republicans are talking about initially just sort of saying, we're going to repeal the bad stuff, we're going to maintain some of the funding and keep this afloat to give us time to actually craft a solid replacement.
A couple of things we're starting to hear about the potential replacement plan from the GOP. One is that it may take years to actually replace Obamacare. It's not going to happen right away. The other is that they would replace the individual mandate with something that's almost exactly like it, which is that you wouldn't be able to avoid getting kicked off insurance for a pre-existing condition unless you have continuous coverage, which is basically the same as the individual mandate.
Right. The Republicans are looking at different ways to have stability. They sort of want to keep people still on plans, telling people, okay, we're not going to mandate you, but you're going to pay the price if you drop your coverage. Also, there is within the Affordable Care Act, the Cadillac tax. It's an excise tax on really expensive plans. It's one of the mechanisms that people were looking at to try to convince and try to sort of coax the market to contain prices. The Republicans get rid of the Cadillac tax, which helps fund some of those subsidies. Instead, they are looking at capping the exemption for employer-sponsored plans. You and I, who get our plans from our bosses, we don't pay any taxes on those very, very, you know, relevant and rich benefits. That exemption every year is, you know, upwards of $200 billion in taxes that the government doesn't collect.
Mm. One more thing, Bertha. We mentioned at the top that Donald Trump said in this interview with Time magazine that he will bring down drug prices. He doesn't like them being so high. And then biotech stocks fell on that news. Can he really do that? Because we know that the U.S. Mm-hmm. is one of the only countries where the government doesn't regulate drug prices.
And under the law, Medicare, which is one of the biggest government programs, cannot negotiate drug prices with drug companies. But, you know, we've seen what the president-elect did with Carrier. United Technologies is a parent company there, where he basically used Twitter and his bully pulpit to get them to keep jobs in Indiana. And then we've also seen now where he has, again, taken to Twitter and said, I think the Air Force One price is too high, even though we don't even know what the next Air Force One price is going to be at the end of the day. So there's nothing to stop him from calling out a biotech executive or a drug company executive and saying, hey, listen, why don't you bring down the price on that new specialty drug? So while legally may not be able to do something. And in fact, his pick for Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tom Price, is against Medicare negotiating prices. That's not to say that he can't take to his bully pulpit. And if you've got the president on the line and you're a healthcare executive, I think you're going to take that call.
That's CNBC's Bertha Coombs joining us from the NASDAQ Stock Exchange in New York today. Bertha, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. My pleasure.
Well, in state governments, emboldened Republicans are also taking up abortion laws. Last week, Texas officials finalized new rules requiring that fetal remains be cremated or given a burial instead of disposed of as medical waste. Abortion rights activists say that makes choosing an abortion more difficult. And in Ohio last night, anti-abortion lawmakers passed the so-called heartbeat bill, banning most abortions after a fetal heartbeat can be detected, which can be as early as 6 weeks into a pregnancy before a woman may realize she's pregnant. Ohio Senate President Keith Faber explained why he thought the measure, twice rejected in the legislature, passed last night.
New president, new Supreme Court justice appointees changed the dynamic and that there was a consensus in our caucus to move forward.
The bill now goes to Ohio Governor Kasich's desk. Reporter Joe Ingles of Ohio Public Radio is at the Statehouse in Columbus. Joe, if this law is signed into law, when would abortions be allowed after a heartbeat is detected?
Well, it's about 6 weeks is when it comes into play. That's about the time that they can determine heartbeat in a fetus. And so a lot of women who are just barely finding out that they're pregnant at 6 weeks of gestation. And that's when this would kick in.
Well, and they would be allowed only if the mother's life is in danger, not in cases of rape or incest under this Ohio law. So let's back up. The 1973 Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision allowed abortion and allowed states to restrict it based on when a fetus could survive outside the womb. Now, the court just said that was somewhere between 24 and 28 weeks. This Ohio law is based on a heartbeat inside the womb and much sooner, as you said, 6 weeks. But women may not know they're pregnant that early. They may find out at 10 weeks in a checkup. Is there an expectation this law will lead to women being charged or doctors being charged?
Well, certainly if it withholds scrutiny and in the courts, it's likely to face a lawsuit. In fact, we're being told that's almost certain if Governor Kasich signs it. If it goes into effect, it very well would mean that women could face charges at that point. And doctors who perform those abortions at that point in gestation would also be held liable.
Now, is Governor Kasich expected to sign it?
Well, that's the big question. You know, he has been saying in recent years that he thinks it's unconstitutional. But so has Senate President Faber. And as your listeners heard at the top, he's kind of reversed his thinking on this now that we have President-elect Trump and we have possibly some more conservative people coming on the Supreme Court. They're thinking, well, you know, maybe this will hold. But we don't know where Kasich stands on it right now because he hasn't weighed in yet.
Yeah. Well, and it's a kind of a definite. Donald Trump has said he's going to appoint a very conservative justice to fill the space that is already on the court. Similar bills have passed in Arkansas and North Dakota, but in higher courts were ruled unconstitutional.
Right. And that's where this is probably going to go. Let's face it, if it does get signed into law, the ACLU and other organizations are saying it's going to go to court. It will be a court battle. Now, one thing to look out for, though, is they've passed this 6-week heartbeat bill. But there's another bill that's going to likely be passed by the end of this week in the lame duck session. And that one would be a gestation, a 20-week gestation at the point when a fetus can supposedly feel pain. So there would be two bills passed, one at 20 weeks and one at 6 weeks. So it's almost like a backup to this one.
Huh. Well, in the meantime, this is long planned. We mentioned that it had been turned back by the legislature before. We're hearing people say that, you know, for 6 years they've been pushing for this. This is quite a victory for abortion rights opponents. What are they saying?
Well, they're very excited. In fact, Janet Folger Porter, who has been pushing this for the entire 6 years, and, you know, they've put out ads, they've put out banners, they've targeted all the lawmakers, they've done numerous things here at the State House to draw attention to this. And so yesterday, when this all happened, she was giddy when she was talking to me. She was very excited, very happy about it.
Yeah. So what happens next? John Kasich, whether or not he signs it is a consideration, then what, if he does?
Well, if he does, then we watch for the lawsuit that comes about. Yeah. But in the meantime, this 20-week abortion ban that's being proposed and will likely pass, that one would go into effect. And that one doesn't seem to have all the controversy around it that this one does. So,
yeah. Meanwhile, John Kasich was not supported by a lot of Republicans in his run. So, you know, who knows what might factor into his decision on this bill.
Correct.
Joe Ingles, reporter for Ohio Public Radio at the Capitol there in Columbus. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Can't get tickets to the Broadway smash Hamilton?
I'm a diamond in the rough, a shiny piece of coal, trying to reach my goal, my power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get cold, I shoulder.
How about moving off Broadway to Spamilton?
I finally reached my goal, now I'm on a roll, but sometimes I screech notes unreachable. When I was 19, but my throat was much older. These New York critics get colder, I shoulder every burden, but now I can...
Spamilton is a parody by American playwright and satirist Gerard Alessandrini, who created the award-winning Forbidden Broadway Parody Review, which ran almost uninterrupted in New York for 25 years. Spamilton satirizes the notion that Hamilton's popularity leaves no room for other shows. The characters parody Hamilton's best-known actors, David Diggs, Leslie Odom Jr., Renee Elise Goldsberry, and most of all, creator Lin-Manuel Miranda. And it's getting such good reviews, you might not get a ticket to this show either. We sat down with Gerard Alessandrini before a recent performance. So, Gerard, how many other playwrights, producers have come up to you and said, why didn't I think of that?
A few, including Lin-Manuel Miranda, said, surprised I didn't think of that, because he's a smart guy. And he could have written the parody himself, I'm sure, if he wanted to. A lot of the ideas in Spamilton, spoofing Hamilton, are very obvious. It's just hopefully we've done them well.
Well, and yes, you have, according to the many extensions you keep getting. Why? I mean, what was your light bulb?
Well, you know, I had done Forbidden Broadway for many years, a show that spoofed Broadway shows, new and old and current and past. And by
the way, let's go there for a second. What was that thought process taking beloved plays into parody?
Well, parody is nothing new. That's been going on for centuries. So it was just, I guess I just came up with the idea of doing all Broadway musicals, all Broadway shows, all the time.
So what might be some examples of how you might spoof other shows in Forbidden Broadway?
Oh, well, there were different levels to do it. You could spoof The Star, which was always fun, especially in the beginning, because there were a lot of stars on Broadway. That was even the era when Yul Brynner was still doing The King and I and Rex Harrison. There were new stars like Patti LuPone. The movie of Evita, she wasn't going to get to do it. Don't Cry for Me, Barbra Streisand, because back then there was rumors that Barbra Streisand was going to do it.
Don't cry for me, Barbra Streisand. The truth is I never liked you.
Patti LuPone is actually a favorite spoof. Then I would do the shows. I would like spoof a whole show, like Les Miserables. It became More Miserables. We would do a medley of numbers from them. Instead of God on High, it was God is High, the song's too high, bring it down. Those were some.
They were singing higher and higher and higher.
Right. And then there was also the fantasy spoofs of when we'd put like one season Cabaret and a revival of The Sound of Music were on Broadway at the same time. And if you know, they're both taking place basically in the same era, in the same place, right? So I put them together.
The cabaret is slightly overrated. The times have changed and Sound of Music's dated.
You know, I basically had dedicated my life to doing it. So when Hamilton came along, I thought, well, gee, this is the biggest hit show that I've experienced in New York since I've been here. Well, if I spoofed Broadway shows for 25 years, I better get busy and spoof Hamilton. Now, Hamilton provided a little different type of parody because it's such a phenomenon, and people immediately started learning the songs and knowing them. So I was just at the bank, an hour ago, and a little... He must have been three at the most, maybe two and a half. Boy came in, so cute, and he was singing, "Look around, look around." He was singing the whole song. So that helps us, because if people know the lyrics, what I do is change the lyrics, you know, turn them inside out, mangle the song. So the more you know the song, the funnier it is.
So here you are, perfectly primed for Hamilton. Everything was, it sounds like, was leading up to this moment. So what jumped out at you from Hamilton where you said, we have to go after that?
My shot. That song. Because that's the one, when you see the show, you think, oh my God, Broadway's back, because it's exciting. It's clear what the leading character wants. And I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. And yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. Lin-Manuel was singing it as Hamilton. As Hamilton, he's just come to New York. He wants to put his ideas across. He meets other people who are interested in the American Revolution, and he's very succinct about what he wants and how he's driven to do it. It does the work of a charm song that you'd find in a Rodgers and Hammerstein show. And I thought, well, it really shouldn't be about Hamilton. It should be about Lin-Manuel Miranda. So he sings, "I'm not going to let Broadway rot.
I am not going to let Broadway rot. I am not going to let Broadway rot. Hey, yo, I'm just like a savior with Beyonce behavior, and I love being a hot big shot. We're really, really hot. I dream
of fine." So I thought, oh, okay, then the story has to be how Lin-Manuel arrives at putting this new type of musical theater together.
So he's come to see it. Twice.
Lin-Manuel has come to see the show, yes. I think he liked it.
Reports were that he was laughing so hard that it was disturbing people around him.
I don't think he was disturbing anybody. Maybe his presence was disturbing. He came with Tom Keel, the fabulous director that directed that show. And he came with Alex Lacamoire, who did the vocal arrangements, which is also outstanding and very, very advanced for what Broadway usually gives you. They stayed after the show, and he talked to the cast. He tweeted that he laughed until his brains came out or something like that. Then he came back a few weeks ago with his family, with his wife and his in-laws.
This is quite a compliment.
Yes, I think it is. Well, you know, I had asked him for some suggestions how to sharpen the show, because we were in previews the first time he came. They suggested moving some numbers. One number they thought was sort of a miss, so I rewrote it. I mean, it's amazing. I just saw the show a few weeks ago, and I felt kind of bad because it's so well written, and I've just mangled the songs to death. On some level, it must be wonderful, but on another level, it must be awful for him to sit there and hear what we did to the songs.
Or to the plot, because, for instance, you have President Obama and First Lady Michelle Obama going to sleep listening to a recording of the Hamilton sound.
It's your choice, Hamilton, Hamlet, or Ham.
In New York.
New York. Just you wait.
Lin-Manuel is Hamilton.
He's the Hammond's Hamilton.
What's that about?
Well, as any good Democrat might know, John F. Kennedy evidently went to the sleep listening to the cast album of Camelot, which was a hit show in its day, a lovely show. And now we call that era of Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy the Camelot era. And I know that the Obamas loved Hamilton, so I thought, wouldn't it be nice to fantasize that they do like the Kennedys did, that they go to sleep listening to the cast album of Hamilton.
So one of the songs from Hamilton that you spoof is "The Room Where It Happens." You've changed it to "I Want to Be in the Film When It Happens."
That's the one that Lin-Manuel said to me, I wish I thought of that. I thought that was obvious because Barbara Streisand gave out the award for Best Musical for the Tonys this year. She came out in her revolutionary garb.
Thank God I picked the right outfit. The Tony goes to Hamilton.
I thought for a minute that's exactly what she was going to say. I want to be in the film where it happens. So
the big finale, "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Tells Your Story," becomes "Who Lives, Who Dies, Who Cries," because everybody does, right?
Right. It's his wife, you know, telling about how the legacy is carried on and what she did afterwards. Of course, I've exaggerated points, but there are real lines there. Like, you know, I built the first orphanage in New York City, and we just exaggerated them slightly. I don't want to give it away, but...
Well, no, I mean, the fact that you have lines from Hamilton and you have the music, although completely, as you said, mangled, it's getting great reviews. But do you think people are also coming because, hey, we can't see Hamilton, we can't afford it, we'll go see Spamilton?
Yeah, I think maybe they are.
My name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things I haven't done.
You're obviously someone who loves theater.
Yes.
What does it do for you when a show like this does come along and, you know, people who are involved with theater just get gobsmacked? Like, look at that, you know?
Well, Hamilton, it just made me rejoice. Because I really felt from spoofing Broadway shows for so many years that it was like a dead art. I mean, there were wonderful revivals of shows that we've all loved for many decades. There were jukebox musicals that brought back music from eras. They were entertaining themselves, but they weren't real theater. They weren't presenting any new ideas. And I miss that. You know, I grew up, you know, with Sondheim and, you know, in the 70s when you'd go see shows, I was a young boy. And every show, not just Sondheim, had a new way of presenting songs in the story. Even Annie and Grease and Chorus Line. And you never knew what you were going to get. It was always a surprise. And so I'm very grateful to the creators of Hamilton, and I was thrilled that Hamilton came along. I can't say that rap was my cup of tea, but it's just great that they found a new way to present musical theater with a new type of music.
What you're saying is, this is your gift to Lin-Manuel Miranda, mangling his songs.
I don't know. I was sitting in that theater watching Hamilton last week feeling very guilty. Grateful that he hasn't come down on me, but he must have a big heart. And somebody's laughing, and that makes me feel good.
Bird, check what we got. Davy Diggs, my pet, hard rock like Lancelot. He's like Goulet, but not. Goulet was stiffer and squat. David's a lot blacker than when Robert played Lancelot. Was Sweeney Todd?
A little more of Spamilton. And we were speaking to Gerard Alessandrini backstage at his new off-Broadway parody of Hamilton. Spamilton's been extended through March. For more, go to herenow.org.
Am I sounding too wise? My verbiage gets me excited, run off at the mouth. I'll tell you, this is what I waited for.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
The U.S. Senate is expected to vote this afternoon on the 21st Century Cures Act, wide-ranging legislation that provides money for medical research and changes the approval process for drug testing. It passed the House overwhelmingly and is expected to easily pass the Senate and be signed into law by the president. Joining us now is NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, tell us more about what's in this bill.
Well, it is nearly 1,000 pages long, so I can't really begin to tell you what's in the bill. It's chock full of details that were negotiated by about 1,400 lobbyists, many of them from pharma. So there's lots of language in there that you could just imagine what it means, and I can't exactly decipher it myself. But in the big picture is it provides money for some big NIH projects, like Vice President Biden's Cancer Moonshot Initiative. And it also contains a lot of revisions to the way the Food and Drug Administration approves drugs and devices. It is supposed to speed up that process. That's kind of as the name suggests.
And it's got bipartisan support in both houses of Congress. Let's listen here to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has said this is the most important legislation Congress will pass this year. Here he is on the Senate floor yesterday.
It supports medical research, including promoting regenerative medicine. It provides real funding to help combat the prescription opioid epidemic that swept our nation, particularly places like my home state of Kentucky.
On the other hand, some have spoken out against this. They say it's a giveaway to the drug companies. Elizabeth Warren, senator from Massachusetts, Democrat, has said that the pharmaceutical industry has hijacked the Cures Bill and it doesn't give enough money for research. Here she is.
This final deal has only a tiny fig leaf of funding for NIH and for the opioid crisis. And most of that fig leaf isn't even real.
Richard, tell us more about what the critics are saying about this bill.
Yeah, well, part of Senator Warren's concerns are that the bill originally guaranteed a substantial infusion of money for medical research for the National Institutes of Health in particular. And that's important because funding there has been declining in real dollars over the past decade. And each funding just has not been keeping up with inflation. And as part of the trade-off for that, the bill was going to relax some of these FDA rules. Well, some of those rules are indeed being loosened, but the amount of money for NIH has been scaled way back in the final version of this bill. And in fact, it's not even guaranteed it'll become part of the annual appropriations process. So they may have to come back and fight for this money on other occasions. Other activists focus on changes to the FDA drug approval process. I talked to Dr. Michael Carome at Public Citizens Health Research Group, a consumer advocacy organization. And, you know, he was concerned that if there's a drug already on the market, drug companies have to do far less to get it approved for other uses. And there are other things like that in the bill that really move things along and concern him.
And just briefly, where does the money come from for this bill? How are these initiatives funded?
Well, Congress does not like to start new initiatives without cutting something else. And in this case, some of the money comes from raiding funds that are in the Affordable Care Act. There were money for disease prevention, and that money is going away.
It's expected
to go away. And so they're raiding that. And also some comes from selling oil that is currently in the U.S. government's Strategic Petroleum Reserve.
Hmm. That's Richard Harris, a correspondent with NPR's Science Desk, talking with us about the 21st Century Cures Act, which is heading through Congress. Richard, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Jeremy.
In Oakland, California today, authorities announced that the search of the fire-ravaged ghost ship warehouse is over. The number of victims stands at 36. Thankfully, it didn't climb higher, but city officials across the country are worried that a warehouse could burn on their watch, and artists are bracing for closings and the loss of affordable space. Let's start in Oakland. On Monday, 5 new illegal housing complaints were filed with Oakland's Planning and Building Department, one of them against another local warehouse. Stephanie Martin-Taylor from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
I went to West Oakland to knock on the door of an artist collective that's housed in an old warehouse. The place is named, and this is chilling in light of recent events, the Death Trap. It's one of the buildings that was named this week in an illegal housing complaint. The city plans to inspect the place tomorrow, which may explain why no one there wanted to talk to me. They said they were holding an emergency meeting about the building's safety and weren't sure yet whether they wanted to talk to the media about their space. So instead, I went to Kilovolt, a coffee shop just a few blocks away. One of the baristas, Eve Hostetler, told me there's a lot of fear in the community right now.
Fear of eviction and just fear of art, like why we came to Oakland in the first place was because we knew we could do this.
Hostetler is a dancer and contortionist who performs in two circus troupes. She says her artist collective is located in an old garage and laundromat. It's relatively cheap and has lots of room for her to practice. She's pretty sure the building is up to code, but she worries that's not the case with other collectives in the neighborhood.
So now there's the fear of, like, if that's going to be taken away from us, like, where to next, pretty much.
Barista William Mitchell is a drummer and electronic artist in two local bands. He does not live in a converted warehouse, but he's always wanted to.
There's definitely appeal. I've always been drawn to it. Like high ceilings and like skylights and like the atmosphere is really nice.
Mitchell performs in these spaces a lot. He says he and his friends are talking about what might happen in the coming months.
There's a lot of worry involved with either places getting shut down or landlords just maybe, I don't know, who's to say what could happen, but just cracking down, if you will, on these spaces and perhaps losing places to live, to perform, to attend events.
Oakland's mayor has called for an investigation into all records of complaint about the Ghost Ship Collective and has asked for an independent review of other spaces that may be operating without permits. Oakland leaders say the fire at the Ghost Ship has made everyone more aware of what can happen when a building isn't safe. The key will be to find ways to preserve these artist communities without putting more lives at risk. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Martin-Taylor.
Well, there are the same concerns from officials and artists across the country. Some artist spaces are completely legal. Those flying under the radar are getting a second look. On Monday, officials in Baltimore evicted dozens of artists from a warehouse called the Bell Foundry after finding code violations, including holes in floors and unsafe wiring. City Councilman Carl Stokes told the Baltimore Sun it was obvious people were living there illegally because laundry was hanging out windows. Elon Battle was among those evicted. He joins us. Elon, during that eviction, were you thinking of the Oakland Fire?
I actually didn't attribute it to the Oakland Fire immediately. I just assumed that it was, like, you know, a long time coming and someone was trying to figure out how to get that space away from us.
Well, now, you and other artists have said that you think that this was just a move to get the space for other developers, for a parking lot. We've heard things like that. And are upset about having to quickly move. So it's sounding like, do you think that officials across the country might be taking, you know, taking advantage, a terrible phrase, of the Oakland Fire to seize properties?
I hate to put it that way, but I do feel like that, honestly, in my heart of hearts. You know, they've been talking to our landlord for a while, trying to make our space into a lot.
A parking lot, yeah.
I'm just already, like, knowledgeable of their intentions with that space.
You're suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but Elon, were you living there?
Yes, I was living there.
Well, but you know that the lease barred people from living there. It was supposed to be a workspace.
Yeah, but I just feel like certain people are allowed to be, you know, left alone in their spaces. Our space was predominantly POC and LGBTQ people. And we made that space a safe haven for everyone to feel comfortable. I just feel like we were kind of being bullied a little bit. And I know that the warehouse spaces across from us aren't going to be bothered. Some of those places have, like, holes in the floor and rats and exposed wiring as well. But it's all about who you know and, I don't know, who you are. I don't know.
So it's interesting you say it was a safe, you had made a safe community and an affordable community for musicians in the LGBTQ community. Mm-hmm. Even if officials and, you know, I can hear listeners saying, well, wait a minute, wiring and holes in the floor and there were beams missing in the ceiling. That doesn't feel safe to them. It felt safe to you, it sounds like. So where are you living now?
I currently am just floating around. I don't necessarily have anywhere to live now.
And how important, given that, are these spaces? Every city has them. They range from, you know, spaces that are highly tended to and maintained and people, you know, pay to get into, but they're still subsidized sometimes by cities, so they're lower cost than other units might be. And then places that are completely, as the Oakland one was, completely under the radar. How important was it to you?
I feel like I found, like, you know, a new part of myself in that space. I think I've learned more skills than I ever have in my whole life, like, just being in that space with those people. They allowed me to stay there even when I didn't have money to, like, you know, contribute to the cause or, you know, the space. It was supposed to be a sanctuary for people. It's just not, like, a cool, like, party place or something like that. It's just, like, a place where people really are welcomed. We love everyone. And I think it was really good for that and helping me nurture my craft. It inspired me so much.
Well, we wish you luck in what comes next. That's Elon Battle, the Baltimore musician among several evicted from the Bell Foundry warehouse for artists earlier this week. Elon, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's bring in Kelly Lindquist, president of ArtSpace. That's a nonprofit real estate developer of artists' housing. Kelly, first, you've been to the Bell Foundry. You told us, you know, you don't know. It could be a land grab. It could be violations. But you agree that there are dangerous artist spaces across the country.
Yes. I'm sad to say that is true. Let's say in cases where we started out 30 years ago in Minneapolis and St. Paul, I will say I went into a number of buildings where I myself walked in and thought, wow, there are children here. There were doors that were propped open that were supposed to be shut. There were other doors that were exit doors that were locked and chained shut. And that's why part of my drive to start ArtSpace and to create this nonprofit that owned and operated buildings where artists can be safe and live affordably permanently.
When you talk about using real estate, what happens? You buy the buildings? What happens?
Right. So in some cases, governments will give us building sites or we will buy sites. We almost always totally gut it and renovate it. But we always, of course, favor the codes that create a safety element for the artists that will be working and living in there.
But how do you keep it affordable? That's why people are gravitating towards these non-regulated buildings.
Right. So let's just take, for example, a project we're doing in New Orleans right now. It's two beautiful old buildings, about 100 years old each, and we are using state historic tax credits, federal historic tax credits, low-income housing tax credits, and bonding dollars. As long as we go ahead and permanently keep this affordable for low-income people and artists, then we do not have to pay back the funds that we receive through all these different financing mechanisms.
Wow. So that's how it works. You don't have to pay it back if you keep it affordable. They're holding you to that.
Exactly.
And the benefit, I'm sure, from the people who raise the money is that this is, you know, helping with the housing problem across the country. You know, you firmly believe that communities thrive when artists are sheltered.
Absolutely. The added plus for getting, you know, 60 or 70 creative people together in a building is that they start working with the community around them through education programs, but also by attracting economic development. So it really changes the community around it. So we have a permanent space that's permanently affordable for creativity.
That's Kelly Lindquist, president of the nonprofit Artist Housing Developer Art Space. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
When you think of charcoal, you probably think of those briquettes you buy at the store for the grill. But for a long time, charcoal bricks were the lifeblood of the Northeast's iron industry, fueling furnaces that manufactured everything from weapons of war to iron train wheels that crossed the country. As Patrick Scahill from Here and Now contributor WNPR reports, you can find that history scattered all over the Connecticut woods.
I think we got to go this way. Sorry.
Emery Gluck and I stumble through the woods of Whitney Forest in eastern Connecticut. Gluck is a volunteer with the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association, and today we're searching for remnants of another era, charcoal.
Unfortunately, it's very subtle, and as you can tell, since I'm having a little harder time remembering where this is.
The charcoal in this forest is basically old wood that was burned in a controlled fire and transformed into a pure form of carbon. It was then used as fuel. Up until the early 20th century, people called colliers made the stuff, and the work wasn't glamorous.
They lived in hovels, in the woods.
Sometimes you can find relics of those hovels, old stone chimneys islanded in the middle of the forest. But Gluck and I are looking for something smaller, less obvious remains of charcoal mounds, and eventually we stumble into some.
Here's some charcoal.
Oh, look at that.
I didn't plant that, I promise you.
Okay. Holding the small shards of black charcoal, you can't help but imagine what it was like to manage a charcoal pit in the 18th and 19th century. Back then, Connecticut's forests would have looked a lot different. Hills were stripped of trees and wood piled to make charcoal. I travel next to Goodwin State Forest in northeastern Connecticut and meet up with Lance Hansen. He's with the State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, and outside of work, he's a bit of a charcoal obsessive.
Looks almost like some kids got rambunctious and stacked some logs.
So, Hansen takes me to a replica he built of a charcoal mound. Wood is piled several feet high, a smaller scale model of what colliers would have done centuries ago to make fuel. There's a chimney in the center.
It's basically stacked logs, and you try to make it as tight as possible because this is where you don't want air coming in. And then you fill the inside of it all with logs, smaller logs, that when you eventually are going to dump in the embers to light it, that's what will catch.
Colliers tended to the embers with a big stick called a Fagan pole.
So the collier could lift it out. They can see from the charring how it's going. As the pile shifts, as it starts to burn, it helps them find the center.
To do this, the collier would actually have to climb on top of the mount and sometimes have to jump the pit, leaping over what was essentially a smoldering hellmouth. One 1901 newspaper account describes a teenage collier who fell 20 feet into one mound, his clothing ablaze as he climbed out of the pit. The teenager walked home and eventually died. But colliers must have thought the risks were worth it. After all, Hansen says the nearby market for charcoal was huge.
You think metal in that time, you'd think Pennsylvania, Ohio would have been the place. No, it was Connecticut. It was the northwest corner of Connecticut. Berkshires of Massachusetts and in eastern New York.
A place called the Salisbury Iron District, which hosted dozens of iron furnaces from the time ore was discovered there in 1731. By a waterfall on the Blackberry River in northwest Connecticut, I look at one of the places where, beginning in the mid-1800s, charcoal from all over Connecticut and later the nation would be burned, the Beckley Iron Furnace. Dick Paddock, a volunteer at the massive restored marble structure, says for nearly 200 years, iron ore from the Salisbury District turned up everywhere, including in cannons used during the American Revolution. Later on, Paddock says local iron was a hit in another market.
Railroad freight car wheels, 33-inch freight car wheels.
Yeah.
For a reason we don't yet fully understand, iron from this portion of Connecticut was exceptionally strong and resistant to cracking. And the contemporary information we have from the period they manufactured them says that they usually would outlast the cars they were under.
But Paddock says the iron industry here had another lasting legacy, open space. Here's what happened. Beckley and other furnaces consumed so much charcoal that acres and acres of land were bought up, trees taken down, burned, and made into charcoal. After a while, it was hard to keep up.
Toward the end of operation here, charcoal and or wood for charcoal was coming from Vermont and as far away as Michigan. So we had consumed our forests.
But the trees on that charcoal land kept growing, even after Beckley closed in 1919.
And that's where we get things like People's State Forest, Great Mountain Forest, Housatonic Meadows. That's all old iron land, iron company land that was being used as charcoal source.
Today, that open space is regrown forest, pockmarked with shards of charcoal, subtle windows into Connecticut's industrial past. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Scahill.
Well, a quick note from Chicago. City workers there removed two street signs early Sunday morning. They were located near Trump Tower and were the remaining honorary street signs left in the city that were named after Trump. The city council voted a month ago, before Trump was elected, to remove the signs after he spent some of his campaign characterizing Chicago as a place riddled with crime, comparing it to a war-torn country. Some Chicagoans want to go even further than removing the signs, though. Architect Jeffrey Roberts and his firm, New World Design, say they want to float four giant golden pig balloons in front of Trump's Chicago hotel, meant to block the Trump sign on the side of the building. The pig balloons are inspired by the cover of Pink Floyd's album Animals, and each represents a year of Trump's term in office. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston and your NPR station. And GEICO, offering motorcycle and RV insurance. More information available on motorcycle and RV insurance at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.